gentlemen of the jury, the prosecution is not going to get that man today. No, because I'm going to get him.
Welcome to our broadcast this evening. You know, cosmic chess match. There's a cosmic chess match going on, whether people know it or not. What we're watching here in the physical, in the earthly realm, is really a reflection of the war in the heavenlies, isn't it? I believe that to be the case, folks. And we're going to be getting into that. You know, we've been talking about, we've been talking about Watchers, the Watchers DNA. L.A. Marzulli, of course, has come out with a new Watchers 10. Go to HagmanandHagman.com, folks. Go to HagmanandHagman.com and HagmanReport.com. Click on the banner there. There's a special offer for Hagman and Hagman listeners. We have L.A. Marzulli as our guest tonight. But there's an ongoing war that's been raging in other dimensions that and spilling over into ours since the beginning of creation. To understand what's going on here in the earthly realm, I believe it's imperative that you understand what has been taking place in the cosmos. When I say cosmos, I'm talking about the heavenly. I'm talking about heavenlies. I'm talking about the Bible. That's what we're going to be getting in today. Welcome. I'm Doug Hagman, my son Joe Hagman. Together, we are the Hagman and Hagman Report. Of course, our websites, HagmanandHagman.com, HagmanReport.com as well. HagmanandHagman.com for the show. HagmanReport.com for, of course, show prep. But I direct you, at this point, to either site. Click on the banner to Watchers 10. And you'll see about the Nephilim hybrids. Why is this important? Well, it's important, folks, because, again, what we're seeing play out here, whether it's in the political sphere or the geopolitical sphere, is in fact related to the cosmic chess match, but related to the Watchers and about the Nephilim. We talk about the Nephilim.
Yeah.
You want to understand that? Absolutely, we want to understand that. And we want to understand why it's important and what has been found over the last, what?
Well, since the founding of America. And L.A. Marzulli has great books, On the Trail of the Nephilim. You can get Volume 1, Volume 2, On the Trail of the Nephilim, as well as Watchers 10 and the Nephilim Hybrids, which is Watchers 10 and Nephilim Hybrids are part of the special.
But yeah, folks, Watchers 10 DNA.
Go to LMRZulli.net.
Yeah. No. Go to HagmanandHagman.com. For the trailers, right.
You can watch the trailers of that he has on there for both Watchers 10 and some other information about the Nephilim cover-up. Well, you go there, watch the trailers, check them out. Just and if you like them, go to Hagman.
You can go to HagmanHagman.com, click on the banner. It'll take you to LAMarzulli.net. It'll take you to our page there that has the trailer on it. Should have been more clear when I explained that to you.
All right.
But it's there. And what a deal it is. Watchers 10, DNA, $20, Nephilim Hybrids, $19.99. You get a free communion CD and a year of PPS, $24 value. Watchers 3, Fingerprints of the Supernatural, also free. What a value there. What a great value, folks. Go to HagmanHagman.com, click on the link to LA or Watchers 10, and then you can see the different images and also the trailer. But that's right. Thank you for doing that. And I was referencing the Cosmic Chess Match from the Cosmic Chess Match by L.A. Marzulli. Great, fantastic book as well. We've got such a great program lined up for you the next 2 hours. We're going to be joined by L.A. Marzulli from LAMarzulli.net. Again, go to HagmanHagman.com or HagmanReport.com. Click on the banner there. It takes you directly to our page, our little page there at LAMarzulli.net that explains all of the specials, but also gives you the trailer, gives you the flavor, and tells you why it's important. Why all this is important? Because people say, well, wait a minute. We got Hillary, we got Trump, we got civil unrest, we got this, we got that. Why is this important? Why are we talking about this? Because this is, as we have said often before, this is the key right now to what's taking place. You have to understand this so the current, present situation can be placed in the proper biblical perspective. With us right now, L.A. Marzulli, lamarzulli.net. Go to HagmanHagman.com, click on the link, and bada bing, you're there. L.A., how are you, sir?
I'm good, Doug and Joe. Thanks for having me on. Great to be here.
Hey, it's about time. Yeah, I feel like saying Zug Zwang. I don't know how many people know that. That's a chess term. Since you wrote the book Cosmic Chess Match, Zug Zwang is a German word for, that means compulsion to move, basically, when you're at a disadvantage in chess.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that. I've played chess for a long time, but I am familiar with that term.
Yeah, yes. So, I mean, that seems like where some, shall we say, some of the Luciferians might be at right now, wanting to utter that term. And it's because of work such as yours that this is being disclosed. So, L.A., let's get rolling. Let's get right into it here. What's going on?
Well, you know, we just came out with what we think is groundbreaking material, Watchers 10 DNA. Of course, the new book, Nephilim Hybrids. They're sort of companion offerings, although Nephilim Hybrids has chapters in it which the DVD does not get into. We posted a short clip on what we call the fairy. It has gone absolutely viral. It's over 500,000 hits now on our YouTube channel in 8 days. It was picked up. The article was picked up by Ancient Origins. It was reposted by other papers in the UK. I mean, it was everywhere last week. And it's, you know, it's really funny, guys, how the Monday morning quarterbacks, the wheelchair generals, just assure their constituents or, you know, the trolls, they'll come on and basically say, oh, this thing's a hoax, it's a bad, it's this, it's that. How can they possibly say that? Have they seen it? I mean, have they looked at this thing? Did they try to do DNA evidence? Have they looked at the x-rays? Of course not. They haven't done any of that, but they're just like the elongated skulls in Paracas. There was a Christian author. I'm sure he's a really nice guy. I know who this guy is. I'm not going to mention his name on the air, you know, out of respect and backbiting and all this nonsense. But he wrote a really nasty hit piece on us, specifically on me, describing, you know, the whole elongated skull phenomena down in Paracas, Bonehead Nephilim. And that was, I think, the title of his piece. And it's very unfair because he's never been there. He's never done any science on this thing. And we have been on this for 3 years on the DNA. And we have real, hardcore, solid DNA evidence, not only from one skull, but from, we basically tested five out of the five, four of them. We had out of the five samples, one is powder, which came from what is called, what we call the Oregon skull, which came out of Peru. Specifically, probably in the 30s or 40s, the guy's grandfather, who was a medical doctor, had this thing in a private collection, along with several other artifacts. It was probably taken out by the good doctor's brother, who was an engineer, and traveled the world building all sorts of projects. So all we can surmise, and look, we've done due diligence, we've gone to the family and asked, well, how did he get this? Well, we don't know, L.A., it's years ago. So we don't know. We have no idea how this happened. All we know is that the good doctor has it. We know it's from Peru, more than likely a museum piece, because right on the forehead it's written La Oroja, and then there's some museum, what we assume are some sort of identification markings, strange numbers, and it's all shellac. So, you know, in the 30s and in the 40s, you take something like this, the museum guy presents it to you, and you put it in your suitcase, and off you go, and no one says anything because nobody cares. And these aren't like we're looting precious antiquities. It was in this guy's private collection, had been in the family literally for decades. We had access to it. We took the powder from the skull. And what I mean by that, we're working with three different DNA labs here. Two in the States, one in Canada. The two in the States will not allow us to mention their names. a fear of ridicule? And because of, yeah, exactly. And because of what we're into. You know, God forbid we actually do real science here and go where the evidence leads us. Isn't that the scientific method? And then, of course, we're accused by some of the Monday morning quarterbacks, you know, we have a theory and we rush off and we're not skeptics. Nonsense. That's the scientific method. You have a hypothesis and then you go and you test it. And our hypothesis has been that these elongated skulls found in the Middle East came, or found in Paracas, came and originated originally from the Middle East. That's what we believe, that they originated from the Middle East, that there was a diaspora about 3,500 years ago when Joshua and Caleb attacked what is now, you know, the Levant, Israel, the land of Canaan, and these Nephilim tribes ran for their lives because the mandate from a loving holy God was to wipe them all out, men, women, and children. Right. Of course, genocide, it's maniacal, it's capricious, unless these beings are hybrid beings that are not supposed to be there at all. And that's what we believe. The Nephilim are a hybrid being, and the Nephilim specifically is the unholy union, the offspring of the only unholy union between the fallen angels and the women of earth, creating this hybrid being known as the Nephilim. This is bizarre, but it's in Genesis 6. It's in Genesis 3. It's in Numbers 13 and the conquest of Canaan. This is precisely the chapter in the Bible that Richard Dawkins points to prove that the God of the Old Testament is this genocidal, homicidal, maniacal, crazy guy. No! The mandate comes down because the Nephilim are there. It's a seed war. It's a cosmic chess match, as you so stated in the beginning of the show. That's what's going on. Move, countermove, move, countermove. So here's the deal.
Mm-hmm.
We get these suits from the Canadian lab. These are what they wear when they do testing. It's a full disposable bodysuit. Hairnet, mask over the face, double gloves, double arms. It's, you know, you slip into this thing, you got boots for your shoes. And Mondo Gonzalez, who was our archaeologist, and myself donned this apparel, and we took DNA from this greatly elongated skull. It's actually, if you go to the Hagman and Hagman, you know, site eventually, you'll see it right there. It's like right, the banner, well, actually you don't, but the banner, the actual cover of a DVD shows that elongated skull. And we proceeded in a way, and the geneticist told us on the camera, I mean, people were going to say, oh, it's contaminated LA, no, it's not. Because what we did is basically, you can't do it any better, except in a sterile room environment with air ducts, blowing all the air and all that. That's the only way you could extract DNA that would be purer than what we extracted. And the way we did that, we turned the skull upside down. We had a Dremel tool. Remember, we're all in this lab garb, and it's all in Watcher's Den. We make a small hole in the bottom of the skull near the foramen magnum. And we'll talk about the foramen magnum a little bit later. And then we take a canister of air, and blow it all out. Then we change the paper underneath where the sample from the skull, the powder was falling. So now we've blown it all out. We have a nice new sheet of paper. We take the Dremel bit and we go in again, go into the skull, and all that is fresh powder, about as uncontaminated as you can possibly get. It falls on the paper. No one does anything. We just fold that paper up, tape that paper up right up to the lab. That's it. It's exposed for probably under 2 minutes to the air. Now, I get that. There's a possibility of contamination even at that point, but we've reduced it by a whole lot. And even our geneticist, Steve Frappietro and Rene Frappietro, stated that on the record. And I'll just, so that's the first one that we did. The other four samples that we had, one of the samples we couldn't extract any DNA, but the other three we were able to extract DNA from. One, we unwrapped a 2,000-year-old mummy skull, baby mummy skull, in Senior Juan's Paracas History Museum. We were allowed to do that several years ago. It's in Watchers 8 when Senior Juan was alive. I mean, who gets to do that? Thank you, Joe Taylor. Thank you, Aaron Judkins. Aaron was our archaeologist at the time, who came down and assisted Joe Taylor on unwrapping this artifact. I took a very small sample of the textiles, which had fallen off as we were unwrapping it. We bagged that. We had a carbon-14 dated. We know it's about 2,000 years old. So it's an ancient artifact, but basically towards the end of the Paracas people, who, by the way, show up in Paracas, Peru, which is right on the coast, the west coast of Peru about 3,500 years ago and vanish, just vanish, kind of like the Anasazi, which is a three-hour conversation, about 2,000 years ago. About 2,000 years ago. So they're there for a period of time, and the carbon-14 dating shows that the baby skull that we unwrapped was about 2,000 years old. Some of the hair, as we were unwrapping, also fell off. That was bagged and sent to the Canadian lab. Other hair was sent to another lab in the United States. So we have the powder, and we have the hair samples. Our hypothesis has been that whoever these are came from the Middle East. That's our hypothesis. We are using the scientific method to the best way I know how to do it. I don't know of any other way to do this except DNA. We have been careful. We have followed protocol. We have brought in experts like Mondo Gonzalez, the archaeologist, Aaron Judkins, another archaeologist. We've used people who are accredited, like the DNA lab, Renee Frappietro and her husband, Stephen Frappietro. I mean, we've got all of our ducks in line. We're doing it right by the book as best as we can. No one's handling the samples. No one's breathing over these things. It's in a sterile environment. When the labs get this stuff, they have no idea what they're testing. The Canadian lab had no idea of what it was testing. The labs in the United States had no idea of what they were testing. Oh, but we have to tell them this. Otherwise, it skews the test. We have to say they're from mummies. It's ancient DNA. You got to tell them that because the extraction process is a little different from my understanding. So we did tell them that. But that's it. They have no idea we're looking at elongated skulls that freak everybody out when they first look at them. They have no idea what they're testing. They're just scientists. You know, it's another day. Here's my sample. I'm going to try to extract DNA. I'm going to see what kind of haplogroup, which comes from the mitochondrial DNA. Mitochondrial comes from the female line, from the woman, the mother side of the family. I'm going to see what the data says. I'm going to write a report. I'm going to send it to Marzulli and Shaw. That's all it is. That's all we're looking at here. You know, nobody's, unlike the Democratic National Committee and Debbie Wasserman Schultz, just kind of moving stuff around and making sure Bernie doesn't win the election. That's not what's going on here. You know, I have to get that in. Or Hillary's emails. Oh, she has no idea. I did not have sex with that woman. Sure, Bill. Mm-hmm. And these people have the audacity to run for public office, but I digress. So getting back to the lab, and I could go down that rabbit hole. You guys know it. I could go right down there. Yep. We'll never get back in the DNA. So here's the deal. We've got all these labs working on it. One of the labs in the States can't extract anything from their samples. I have no idea why. The other lab in the United States was able to extract mitochondrial DNA and was able to give me reports. And we have those reports, and those reports are published verbatim in Nephilim Hybrids in the back of that book in the appendix. There they are. You can read them for yourself. The lab in Canada was able to extract from the powder. Now, before I tell you the results, here's what we need to know. Why is this important? Because the Darwinian theory and Darwinists claim that at the end of the last ice age, and that's disputable as the day 10, 12,000 years, whatever it is, okay, the Bering Strait, that waterway which we know now, the Bering Strait was a land bridge. And people from Asia crossed that land bridge into the New World and populated the Americas, both North America, Central America, and South America. That's sacrosanct in both academia and the scientific community. That's what you are taught in school, and anybody who says anything else is immediately dealt with. In fact, I have an archaeology book here. It's sort of archaeology 101, and the guy just excoriates the idea that, you know, that people put sails on boats from Egypt and sailed over to, you know, the New World before Columbus. It's just nonsense. It was all disproven 100 years ago, blah, blah, blah. Well, excuse me, Thor Heyerdahl did exactly that. He's the author of Kon-Tiki, which most people, I'm assuming, have read. But he also wrote a book that most people have not read called Ra. And Ra was another boat like Kon-Tiki. And what he did is he built a replica of a papyrus boat that would be about 3,000 years old. Put a sail on that baby, sails out the Mediterranean, and the trade winds take him to Barbados, without doing anything, guys. Without doing anything, he winds up in Barbados. So he showed us that this could be done. But the Darwinists won't look at that. Okay, I get that. So here we are in the lab. We have no idea what the DNA is going to come back at. And if it, you know, we're assuming, well, you know, if we're wrong, then, and the Darwinists are right, then what it should show us is some sort of an Asian origin in the haplogroup. So let's start off with the hair. The hair sample shows a European ancestry, the haplogroup, a rare European mitochondrial haplogroup originating in Europe, with also a percentage found in the Middle East. That's not supposed to be there. It's groundbreaking, absolutely groundbreaking. It shows us that the origin of the Paracas people are not from Asia. And Brian Forrester, our colleague, was down in Brazil and talking to the locals. And there's a trail that one of the locals told him about. They're out in the bush in the middle of nowhere. And this trail is called the Cusco Trail, something like that. Cusco is in the highlands of Peru. And according to the oral tradition of the natives, and they were in a native village, people came and landed on the east coast of Brazil, and they hiked upwards this trail to Cusco thousands of years ago. So, I mean, you know, people are curious, Doug and Joe. They want to go someplace. They want to travel. And if they're being hunted down and killed, like we read about in the biblical prophetic narrative of Numbers, when Joshua and Caleb are going in, and these are the Nephilim tribes, and the conquest of Canaan is taking place, we believe, and our hypothesis has been, that there was a diaspora of these giant tribes. And if that's the case, we should find evidence of it, and we do. So right off the bat, we've got a European origin. All this, by the way, all of it is in Watchers 10 and verbatim in the book, Nephilim Hybrids. You know, go to your site, HagmanandAvin.com. It's right there, Watchers DNA. Click the banner. You can avail yourself of what we think is groundbreaking information. Let's go back to what we call the Oregon skull, greatly elongated. Guys, there's a picture of it. You can see it in Watchers 10. It's up on your site also. But this thing from the brow ridge, which is that if people listening to this show, just touch your eyebrows and just go up about a half an inch. That's called your brow ridge. Well, this skull in Oregon, unlike many of the Paracas skulls, right from the brow ridge, this thing goes back at a 45-degree angle. There is no forehead. You know, slap your forehead, right? It goes straight up from the brow ridge. Not this thing. This thing goes back at a 45-degree angle. It is greatly elongated. I've shown this picture to medical doctors. There's no way you can elongate that. There's no way you can cradle headboard an infant, you know, wrapping it in boards and somehow bend the forehead back. I mean, how do you do that? I mean, I get it. The kid's pliable, but you can't bend the forehead. There's no joint there. You can't do it. You'll kill the kid. It's genetic. We believe it's genetic. Here's the kicker. The powder from the DNA, or the DNA, the haplogroup that we extracted DNA, it was mitochondrial DNA, and the haplogroup from the greatly elongated skull that we tested in Oregon, it was T2B, which points to, drumroll please, a Syrian Mesopotamia origin, which is Nephilim Central. That's where all this started. Thousands and thousands of years ago. Guys, it's groundbreaking. It is. It's groundbreaking stuff. And it blows away the critics, at least right now. We are desperately trying to get back down there and take multiple samples, now that we know how to do it with the powder, from many different skulls. And we have verbal permission from a Peruvian archaeologist we've been working with for well over almost 2 years now, 18 months to 2 years, working with this one gentleman who works at a very well-known museum in Peru. And supposedly this week he's taking all of our information, everything else, traveling to Lima to secure the permits. Once we get the permits, I bring the team down and we extract DNA, and it goes right to three different labs, and we'll tell you what the results are. So why is this important? you know, Christians are out there is going, I don't understand why L.A. Marzulli is spending all this time and money doing this stuff, because it points back to the veracity of the biblical prophetic narrative. It points back that there were intruders here that were not human. It points back to the veracity of the Genesis 6 account and the Genesis 3 account, that the seed of a serpent will be at war, at enmity with the seed of the woman. That's what it points back to. And that's huge. There is a supernatural. The seed war is ongoing. And we've got proof. We have proof that these people, and they're not really people. I call them the soulless ones. They look completely different from other human beings, in our opinion. And I think the skulls bear that out. The mitochondrial DNA is showing a European / Middle Eastern origin, which is not supposed to be there. When we extract enough DNA to get nuclear DNA, that's when it's going to be telling. That's when you know, our chickens will come home to roost. Because what we're hoping for there is that what we should see are anomalies, great anomalies. In fact, what we're hoping for is when we get the nuclear DNA, that there will be parts of the genome which just are aberrant, that just shouldn't be there, unknown. And that's our hypothesis, and I'm telling you ahead of time.
Man. L.A., this is fascinating. Every Christian should understand this knocks Darwinism out of the park. You've essentially proven, I believe, or at least substantiated, not that it needed to be, much of the Bible, but nonetheless, you make sense through your scientific research, and yes, scientific research, that the Bible provides an accurate historical account. Details that not only account for a time long ago when heavenly beings cohabitated, I guess is an interesting word, with human women and produced a race of giants, but details that indicate a return of those beings and a renewal of events now viewed as ancient history. We're going to be right back. Our guest, L.A. Marzulli, hang in with us. Watchers 10. L.A. Marzulli is our guest, author, expert on the supernatural, speaker extraordinaire. Now, Watchers 10 is out, folks. Go to HagmanandHagman.com. Click on the banner link right there. It's right there, or HagmanReport.com. Either one. It'll take you right to Watchers 10 DNA. What a great special L.A. Marzulli has put together for our listeners. But we're talking about Nephilim hybrids, and we're talking about the DNA, his findings, the findings of the DNA tests that they engage private laboratories. And you know something, folks? It's interesting, because the testing was done by exact scientific standards, and the results are amazing. But what does this all have to do with the price of tea right now, as they used to say? Because it speaks to not just the presence, or the existence, I should say, of a godly small g offspring back in a time referenced by the Bible, but the return from that long gone era. L.A. Marzulli is our guest. L.A., thanks for hanging with us. Man, what an incredible story, and certainly one that would put Darwinists and those people who don't want to face the truth, put them on the defensive, right?
Well, you know, it does, and it's certainly my pleasure to be here, guys. I mean, it's an honor to be on the Hagman Report. Every time I'm here, just, you know, we have a hoot. And it was great to meet you guys face to face at in Dallas a while back at the Hear the Watchman conference, which was certainly a success, and it was just good hanging out and, you know, finally getting to meet you guys and spending some time together. It was
wonderful.
It was really good. Really cool.
You know, I got to tell you, LA, one of the connections that you, me, and Joe were at the Nephilim Mounds conference in Columbus or Dublin, Ohio, and attending that conference and hearing your presentation and then seeing the mounds made me, it kind of like put everything together for me in terms of what's really going on and how this relates not just to previous past historical events, biblical accounts, but also the present and the recent past as well. So, Elliot, just go ahead, man. You got the floor.
You're knocking it out of the park. I want to. You know, we're talking about some of these cover-ups and Nephilim hybrids. You know, the book and it talks about there's a chapter about and I don't really get into that, but there are some chapters in it which are different than the DVD. That's why they go together. But in On the Trail of the Nephilim Volume 2, and we talked about this last time I was on the show, or a while back anyway, and we were discussing the work that I did out on Catalina Island. Catalina Island is about 27 miles off the west coast of California, specifically right across from Los Angeles. There's ferries that go out there all the time. Wrigley, the heir of the, you know, Wrigley chewing gum magnate, that guy built this huge theater in the Round. There's movies that are shown there. It's a tourist trap. Avalon, the city of Avalon. I mean, it's a tourist trap, and you can't go outside of Avalon unless you're you live on the island, and most people, you know, don't live on the island. So every day people go over, especially in the summer. The ferries go over, I think, every couple of hours, and hundreds of people go out, and it's a tourist trap. The best time to go is in January during the rainy season, where nobody goes over there, and then it's really cool, and that's when we go over. Anyway, we got wind. I was reading this book by Jim Watson. We carry the book. It's called Mysterious Catalina. And in it, he was discussing this archaeologist guy who was apparently hired by the High Museum. And the High Museum was later gobbled up by the Smithsonian Institute. This is all back at the turn of the last century, 1919, 1921. So it's, you know, getting on 100 years here. It's old news. And Watson talked about this archaeologist by the name of Ralph Glidden, no relation to Glidden Paints, Ralph Glidden, who had been hired by the High Museum to conduct primitive archaeological digs on the Channel Islands. The Channel Islands go from Santa Barbara down to San Diego. It's a string of islands, San Miguel, Santa Rosa, San Nicolas, Santa Catalina. And that's the one we were on. So I get wind. I read this book, Mysterious Catalina, Jim Watson. He's talking about Ralph Glidden. And in the book, he mentions that Ralph Glidden stated that he discovered nine-foot skeletons out on the island of Catalina. So I get a hold of this guy. I, you know, look him up online. Isn't it great? You know, the internet, we can Google somebody and there they are. You know, Jim Watson, Mysterious Catalina. Contact info, click email, click type, send, you know, there it is. I mean, you go back 50 years and all that's impossible. You know, you just don't, nothing moves that quick. 25 years ago, nothing moves that quick. Now, within 15 minutes, I'm sending this guy an email. I think a day later, he emailed me back. We struck up a conversation. I took him to dinner. One thing led to another. Watson's telling me the story. Hey, LA, are you aware that John Borregina, who at the time was the curator of the Catalina Island Museum, just discovered the lost cache of records from Ralph Glidden? These things have been missing literally for decades. He found them in the Wrigley Theater, in the attic of the Wrigley Theater. Part of the duties of the curator of the museum, at least a while back when Borregina was the curator, was to run the projectors. I guess different people took turns doing it. They would run the movie projectors in the theater. So it's movie night, Friday night, whatever. Borregina has seen the movie too many times. He's bored, and he starts rummaging around in this vast attic. Now, I've never been to the attic, but I'd love to go there just to see it. Apparently, it's pretty good size because the theater is actually pretty big. Anyway, Borregina is rummaging around, and he finds this trunk. It's like, this is like right out of some Steven Spielberg movie, right? He finds the trunk in the corner of the attic, you know, stuff piled over it. And he like opens the trunk and start rummaging through it. And he realizes, because he's the curator of the Catalina Island Museum, that these are old documents. What's more, he comes to the startling realization that these are the lost papers and photographs of Ralph Glidden. And this made, you know, LA Times news. This was like big news when it hit. And so archaeologists go out there, anthropologists go out there, everything is cataloged in manila envelopes, pictures are put into plastic sleeves, everything is then stuffed in the museum boxes are put into an air-controlled vault. I get wind of the story by Jim Watson, who tells me this. I contact the museum. Yes, Mr. Marzulli, but no, you can't come out and look at the lost records. Okay. Well, how about if I bring an archaeologist with me? I'm sorry, Mr. Marzulli, blah, blah, blah. This went on for 6 months. Finally, I got wind, and Jim Watson told me that, well, you know, maybe if you make a donation to the new museum, they might allow an exception. So I once again emailed them and said, look, I'm willing to make a $1,000 donation to the museum if you'll allow me, to come back or to come to the museum and look at the records. And the moment I stated that, Mr. Marzulli, come right in. And we drew up a very loose contract, and I flew out to the island. I hired a private pilot. The reason for this is I wanted to get into the interior of the island, which, by the way, the Conservancy owns it, and it's pristine. Many parts of it looked exactly like it looked when Ralph Gooden was there in 1919. There are wild buffalo on the island. I wanted to see all that. And so I chartered a plane, Terry Johnson, and this guy's like a flight instructor. So I drive down to the airport, which is near Long Beach, but it wasn't at Long Beach. I can't remember the name of the town. Anyway, so I meet Terry, and I knew this guy before. He's a friend of a friend, brother of a friend, and he takes me out to the runway strip, and there's the plane. It's got two sets of controls. So I'm saying to myself, oh, that's pretty cool. And the light bulb's not going off in my head yet. So we get in the plane, and he goes, well, you're going to fly. And I go, what? He goes, yeah, I'm a flight instructor. You knew that. I go, yeah. Well, there's two sets of controls. You're going to fly the plane. And I start laughing. I go, you have got to be kidding me. He goes, no. So he hands me a clipboard, and I have no idea what I'm looking at. So he's giving me this fly by your seat of the pants. You know, this is what this dial does. This is what this is. Here's the checklist. Let's go down the checklist. I've got the headphones on with the microphone. You know, where he's talking to the tower, I'm not saying a word. We fire up the engine. We start taxiing down the runway. Guess who's taxiing down the runway? Yours truly. I have no idea what I'm doing. And you want to grab the wheel, but the wheel doesn't do anything. You've got to do it with the pedals on the floor with your feet. And what you're doing is you're braking. When you brake with the left foot, you hold that wheel and the plane moves to the left. That's how it works. When you brake to the right, the plane moves to the right. And so, you know, yeah. I got the trick, the hang of it. And I'm jockeying. I couldn't believe this, right? I'm like moving the plane down the runway. And then, okay, turn. So I make the turn, and he goes, okay, I'll take off. So he takes off, and I'm like a kid in a candy store. This thing's like a go-kart. I've never been in a small two-seat plane like that, you know, a little Cessna training plane like that. Never. And so it just bounces along like a little go-kart, except you're in the air. And you don't get the sensation that you're moving. Anyway, so we're you know, out of the airport, we're flying over the ocean, and it's only like a 25-minute flight. And he goes, okay, take the stick. I go, what? He goes, take the stick. And so he goes, you know, and he shows me what to do. So I'm flying the plane. And I go, can I dip it a little? He goes, sure. So I dip to the left a little, dip to the right. I'm like, I got pictures, you know, that he took. I'm like grinning so big, I thought my face was going to break. I mean, it's just a blast. So, you know, we land the plane, and Watson and his friend pick me up in this ancient VW bus, and we drive through the interior. We're looking at Buffalo. I'm looking at the lay of the land the way Ralph Gooden must have seen it almost 100 years ago. Nothing has changed. Wild Catalina Island. I mean, what a treat. We get to the museum. We get to the museum, and John Borogina's there. It's like 5 o'clock. He ushers me into this little side room off the main part of the museum, and there are two tables, 8-foot tables, with paper on them, fresh white paper. And he goes, what would you like to see first? I go, well, the pictures. I set up my camera on the tripod. He goes to the vault. He opens the vault up, and he takes out museum boxes. Now, I want you to know something, guys. On the record, Borogina stated in On the Trail of the Nephilim, Volume 2, some of the pictures went missing. He states it on the record. Because he's the first guy that handled all this stuff. And he said some of the pictures that he saw went missing. He has no idea why or who took them. That's a fact, stated by the former curator of the museum who was fired. And we still really don't know why he was fired, but that's, you know, another two-hour conversation with conspiratologists, and we won't get into that. Let me take a slight slurp of water here.
Well, and we're talking with L.A. Marzulli. Folks, go to Hagman at Hagman.com. Click on the banner. It takes you right to L.A. Marzulli's page there, where Watchers 10 is out. Now, folks, look, I don't want you to think that this is sounds like an infomercial, but I'm not going to defend that either. The information in here, as far as I've seen Watchers 10. It's worth every cent because it does put in perspective. Well, number one, it documents the findings. Number two, it gives you a glimpse into the process of the DNA sequencing or the DNA identification and sequencing. I suppose to be precise, but it also, in the larger sense, it verifies, it authenticates what's in the Holy Bible, and also it gives you, well, remember I say past is prologue, right? It tells you, basically, it gives you a glimpse into what very well could be coming. L.A. Marzulli is our guest. Go ahead, sir.
So I'm in the museum, and I want to see the pictures. Borogina goes in, gets a museum box out, places it on the table. I have white gloves on. My camera is next to me on a tripod. I open the box up, and all this is on the Trail of Nephilim, too. You can see it. And there it is. It's like pictures, Santa Catalina Island. And I pull the folder out. I start looking through the folder. I'm only there for maybe an hour or two, and I'm hitting pay dirt. What I mean by that, I'm seeing elongated skulls. I'm seeing skeletons with six fingers. I'm seeing giant skeletons that shouldn't be there. The picture that I found, which basically went viral, and I was also did an appearance on the History Channel's In Search of the Lost Giants with the Vieira brothers in 2015. I was on their season finale. And that picture they showed, and that's my intellectual property. That's my discovery. I was the guy that went in the archives and found that. Nobody else did. I found it. And it's my intellectual property. And I have to state that because the History Channel made it look like the Vieira brothers found it. They didn't find it. I tipped them off and told them I foolishly will never do this again. I said, yeah, I just found something. Well, can you show me? Okay, but, you know, don't do any. And I sent them the picture like an idiot and trusting. Now, the Vieiras are good guys, but the History Channel massaged it so it made it look like they discovered this. Nothing could be further from the truth. So Gary Stearman, my older brother, who I affectionately call Elder Brother, and, you know, we were all together, like you mentioned it, you know, Nephilim Mound 3, and, of course, you know, some of the other prophecy conferences that we were at together, so it's always good to hang out. But Gary said, L.A., there are people with computer programs that have programs which can take the photograph and digitize it and tell you exactly how big that skeleton is. So I put an ad up on my blog looking for someone who can do this. We had four people. Out of the four people that volunteered, three of them followed through. The fourth guy didn't, but he stated he stated unequivocally that the photograph, in his opinion, was 99.999% genuine. It was not photoshopped in any way. And that's very telling, and we needed to know that. The other three men took the photograph, digitized it on their programs, and knowing the height of Ralph Glidden, because Borogina did extensive research on this guy because they found the lost records, and that was a huge museum deal. I mean, that was the display for a year, at least a year, in the Catalina Island Museum. So this was a big deal. And numerous witnesses put Ralph Glidden at about 5'8". 5'8".
Right.
Okay? So we know the height of Ralph Glidden. And the picture that I discovered, which was shown on In Search of the Lost Giants, and then three experts digitized it and went on the record extrapolating the size of the giant skeleton that is shown in that picture. The picture shows Ralph Glidden standing in a recently excavated grave. In front of him, in situ, it's not a bone pile, in situ, is a very, very large skeleton. All of these guys, and there's no collaboration between any of them. Each person doing the research thought he was the only person working on it. When I got the results from all three, I said, okay, guys, surprise, surprise, and sent them all, you know, each other's emails so they could compare notes at that point. So it wasn't colored in any way. And all of them put the skeleton at just under 9 feet. You can't have that. That's not supposed to be there.
Well, wait a second. Just under 9 feet. Isn't LeBron James?
He's like 6'11".
Oh, okay.
6'10".
No, I was. That was my ill attempted humor. But so the significance. 9 feet. What are we looking at here? Just some abnormality here with respect to the human race?
No, because there was another skeleton, another picture of a skeleton that we found, which one person extrapolated, and he believed it was just, again, under 9 feet. This skeleton had six fingers.
Okay.
Six fingers. Plain as can be, six fingers. So all this points back to the veracity of the biblical prophetic narrative, as well as the ancient oral traditions from Native Americans, which talk about six-fingered, red-haired, cannibalistic giants roaming the Americas. And certainly Steve Quayle's work, you know, points to this, and, you know, bully for Steve. Get his books, folks, if you want to find out more, but also get mine, because we're plowing in the same field, but we do different things. And that's why both tomes are just as valid. So here's the deal.
Parallel investigation, I just want to point this out. Parallel investigations coming to the same conclusions. You know, you talk about substantiating the not just the biblical account, but one investigative research project, yours, the other Steve's, two luminaries in this field substantiating one another. You cannot make this up, and certainly this would go great in a court setting if you had to testify in front of a jury. So, perfectly said. Go ahead, sir. Continue.
So we have the picture. We know it's 9 feet, just under 9 feet. Groundbreaking stuff. Again, something we're not being told. You know, Scotty Walter, American Earth. His opening line is, you know, the history we know is all wrong. He's right. I mean, Scotty just nails it. The history that we've been taught is all wrong, and it is. It's a managed agenda. We're not being told the truth. We're not. And anything that points back to the veracity of a supernatural is dealt with, because you can't have a supernatural. Oh, you can go to church all you want, but, you know, if the supernatural, if God starts showing up, whoa, watch the elders have a cow over that. They don't want it, because it's going to rock the boat. And every demon-possessed guy within 25 miles will make a beeline to your church, guaranteed. I've seen it, guaranteed, because the supernatural is sloppy. Well, what do you mean the supernatural is sloppy? Okay, two gold coins coming out of a fish's mouth, floating axe heads, talking donkeys. You don't think a talking donkey is sloppy? Are you kidding me? How do you deal with that? So anyway, Richard Shaw and I want to go back to Catalina to film me there. It's now about 8 months since On the Trail of a Nephilim has come out with all that evidence, all the analysis of the photographs themselves, the elongated skulls, six-finger giants, you know, just under 9 feet, all that, the pictures, my appearance on History Channel. We go out to the Catalina Island Museum. It's just Richard and I. You know, people go, well, how many people in your crew, L.A.? They don't understand. It's guerrilla filmmaking. It's Richard Shaw with a camera. That's it. And me with a microphone clipped onto my lapel of my shirt. That's it. That's it. There is no crew. It's guerrilla filmmaking at its best. And Richard does such an amazing job in editing, and as a director, that's why the production quality of these things get better with each one. I mean, he's really got it wired. He's really an expert at what he does. So, bully for Rick. We go into the Catalina Island Museum, and there in front of us, blown up on the wall. Remember, this little photograph I have is a 5x7 photograph, black and white. The photograph that's on the wall is the photograph that I discovered that was in the archives in a plastic sleeve, in a Manema envelope, you know, sealed in a museum box, which was then stuffed into a vault, locked up, more than likely, never to see the light of day again, okay? And here it is, the picture. And by this time, remember, the History Channel's already done it. My book's already been out. It's gone viral. It's all over the internet, blah, blah, blah. There's the picture, blown up, 2 feet wide, 18 inches high. It's huge. And there's Ralph Glidden, leaning on a shovel in a recently excavated tomb. The problem is, guys, the giant, which should be in front of Ralph Glidden, in situ, lying, where everybody could see it, is no longer in the picture. The picture has been cropped. The giant has been redacted. It is no longer there. It's a deliberate obfuscation on the part of the Catalina Island Museum. Whoever told them to do it, it's completely disingenuous. Why did they do this? All of this, wait till you see it in Watchers 10. It's just a mind blower. And we hold up, Rick goes running over with my book. We flip to the page, full page, and it's an 8.5 by 11, oversized, full color book, Armature of a Nephilim Volume 2. And we hold it up in the museum underneath the picture. So here are the two pictures. What's wrong with this picture? I mean, why would they do this? And once again, anything that would point back of a supernatural is dealt with. This is a cover-up. And you know what drives me nuts about this, guys? This is a scientific method, isn't it? I go out to the island because I have a lead. I don't know whether this lead is true or not. I have no idea what I'm going to find on the island. But I do due diligence. I spend $1,000 of my own money and go out there and charter a plane and spend 10 hours in the museum going over and over and over and finding all this stuff. Every shred of newspaper article and journal and everything else this guy wrote, I pored over the entire collection. I find the stuff, I get it analyzed, I publish my findings. That's a scientific method. That's how it works. And here it is. If I'm wrong, then you go take a picture of the picture and then give it to your people and you tell them what we're looking at. The fact that they redacted it shows us, just like, you remember the climate change summit that they were going to do? And the whole thing, the emails came out, and it's like, well, we threw the evidence out because we didn't like that, and we just created new evidence that would prove that's not science. That's junk science. People, the skeptics will call what I do junk science. Oh, really? Well, why is it junk science? Because I take a picture, and three experts extrapolate that? Because we go to DNA labs with real geneticists? That's not junk science. That's hard. That's every bit as valid as anything anybody else is doing in the scientific community. But the evidence, some people don't like where the evidence goes because it points back to the supernatural origin of the Nephilim. The giants were here. They roamed the earth. And I wish, you know, we'd have no idea what happened to the skeletons that Ralph Glidden exhumed. All we know from one entry is that they were piled on board one ship, and that ship was caught in a storm in the Channel Islands, in the channel between Catalina and Los Angeles, and promptly sank to the bottom.
Interesting.
It's a very, very deep channel.
And not only does it prove, you know, the biblical account of, you know, the fallen ones and the children that they bore, it proves that the Bible and the accuracy of the Bible.
Sure.
It proves that the Word of God is true. And, you know, the furtherment of developments and archaeological finds all continue to prove that the Bible is accurate.
That's right. And I just want to say this. For those in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, in situ means, of course, in their original position, in the original position found. Just to clarify that for people in Hattiesburg. Folks, our guest, L.A. Marzulli. That's lamarzulli.net. Go to Hagman and Hagman.com. Click on the link to Watchers 10. I got to tell you, I was absolutely blown away by Watchers 10. What a great deal.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
You know, we're going to be right back with L.A. Marzulli
for another hour. Stay with us.
Yeah, can't wait.